79% of founders feel anxious to a point that it's detrimental to their work. That's fucked up. We present this picture of a founder, of this very masculine approach of just like, fake it till you make it. There's a lot of founder ego and painting this very curated image of myself. And I think it works to our detriment because often the humility of understanding where your weaknesses are and where your blind spots are, that becomes a strength. And you need to be willing to be like, hey, I don't know what I'm doing on this point and I need your help. And I'm overwhelmed right now. And I think rarely founders, even though they experience overwhelm and stress and anxiety, are encouraged to go to that place of openness and vulnerability. How do we have such a good relationship with our VCs?
You know that when to release tension, it's important to shake the body.
Oh, is it?
Yeah. So you see, like, if a gazelle gets pursued by a lion and she survives, the first thing she'll do is, like, shake the whole body because it gets the trauma out of the muscles. But we as humans, we don't do that. We just, like, crisp everything in. So after you've had a stressful conversation, you're meant to, like,
shake it out.
Yeah.
There was a study shared on the founders' parents group.
Okay.
Of which I'm a part of, being the only non-parent, because I set it up, so I get access. And there was a study shown, which was the things that helped mental health challenges the most.
Yeah.
In order. CBT and therapy, third. Second was a walk or, like, light jog by exercise. Top one was dancing.
That's my trick. I dance every single morning after waking up. Yeah. At least 10 minutes of dancing every day.
It's
changed my life.
Nice.
Okay.
So, welcome.
Thank you.
What should people know about one night only Margaret de Broglie?
Thank you for having me, first of all. My name is Margot, and I'm the co-founder of Juno. Juno is a financial education app, which I started about 3.5 years ago. Outside of work, I am a dancer. We were just speaking about dancing. I am a big foodie. I'm passionate about kind of discovering different pieces of myself and living closer to a life that makes me feel excited to wake up every day. And I started Juno with my sister. Yeah, that's pretty much me in a nutshell at the moment, I think. I'm 26. I'm half French, half German.
Given that we mostly talk about relationships at work, and it's always an interesting dynamic meeting people who start companies with their siblings.
Yes.
How has that journey and experience been?
So my sister and I are only have 1 year difference, so we're really, really close. It's almost like we're twins. Alex is the older sister. I genuinely can't imagine founding a company with anyone else because it's such a stressful relationship. It's just submitted to so much pressure from, you know, outside forces, but also from yourself internally, that I think having the foundation of love and trust that we've built over the many, many years is essential. And, you know, they always say you want to create a culture of a family. Well, we are genuinely a family. But I think the biggest piece is we know how to fight with each other, and we fight all the time, but fighting is no big deal. If you have siblings, you know that you can fight like 5 times a day, and then it's just like, cool, let's go grab lunch. I think a challenge that I see in a lot of working relationships is people hold back information because they're scared of hurting someone's feelings, or they're scared of how to phrase it well, and they'll only share feedback in this sort of very structured way. Whereas with your sibling, it's like, what the fuck are you doing? What is wrong with you? Like, this is stupid. And you have this sort of, you know, transparency and candidness, but with a foundation of love. And I think those two combined mean that we know exactly what the other person is thinking, and there's nothing that builds up or nothing that kind of gets brought into a bigger thing than it needs to be. I think it's been a superpower, and it's brought us closer than ever. I mean, the first 6 months of building the business, we were not only co-founders, but we were also not paying ourselves a salary. So we were sharing a room. We were sharing a double bed for 6 months whilst we were building the business. So you literally open your eyes and there's your co-founder next to you in your bed. And I think you can only do that with a sibling.
That is intense.
Yeah. Yeah, really intense.
About, like, marrying your co-founder, literally waking up next to them every day for 6 months.
It blows my mind that people can start businesses with their partners, because I don't know how you would keep any sort of, like, desire and sexual tension alive in that kind of context, because it's like you're constantly thinking about work and then they're next to you in bed. How do you... Yeah. It's very difficult to box things separately because it just becomes part of your relationship. Like, work becomes such an essential part of what you speak about. And I think it's a mistake that I see a lot of founders make. They rush into co-founder relationships a lot too quickly. Mm. And it's like, yeah, that person is a friend and you know them really well outside of a work context. Do you know what they're like when they're stressed? Do you know what they're like when they're under a deadline or something like that? And if you haven't seen them operate in that kind of container, then don't start a business with them, because you'll be surprised by what comes up and how people actually are in those moments.
It does seem that a lot of people get excited at the start, which I've done a lot of times in the past, and gotten married to somebody way too early. The interesting part that I heard from describing why your co-founder relationship works is knowing how to fight.
Yeah.
And there's obviously, like, there's that element of love there, because they're your sibling.
Yeah.
Is there a certain, like, type of way that you fight that you find is really effective, or is it just like the fact that it's completely unfiltered?
Yeah.
Is that what makes it effective?
I think the unfilteredness and the spontaneous nature of just sharing whatever we're feeling at a given moment, rather than kind of withholding information and then sharing it at a different time or something like that. I think that makes really good fighting. But then also just being super aligned on values as a fundamental piece. Like, we've never actually disagreed on any of the foundational pieces of the work. Mm. Where we disagree, it's often actually to our benefit, because it creates kind of this, you know, tension that makes us better, both of us. Mm. But when we had a team, we actually realized that we had to often, you know, we had to take separate rooms to speak with each other, because if we spoke with each other in front of the team, they'd be shocked at the way we speak with each other, because they see us as their bosses and their co-founder, you know, the co-founders, and we speak with each other as siblings. So we had to make sure that we actually take those conversations separately and then kind of present a more unified and a more proper front in front of the team, rather than fighting the way we do in front of them, because it doesn't help them, because they're not in our dynamic and they don't need to be part of that dynamic.
So how do you draw the line between what should be shared with the team, or what the team should see and what they shouldn't?
I'm a firm believer in being as transparent as possible with people. I think we've always been very authentic and candid with them. But I think people get a little bit scared when they feel conflict or hostility. And I don't think that's the type of emotion that breeds a positive working culture. Because if you're fighting with anyone that's not your sibling, that's a big deal. And I never fight with people that aren't, you know, my sister, because we find different ways of communicating with each other. So I just don't think that's helpful to infuse the culture with that, the very transparent kind of fighting.
What does fighting look like, as opposed to...
It's not fighting. It's a good question. We're not physical, first of all. I think that would be a big problem.
Many employees would be shocked if they saw one of you punching the other one.
But there's I think we get into a flow as a sort of very reactive, where we almost like ping pong on what the other person has said, and that makes us a lot better. So if we're preparing a pitch or something like that, there's tension there that we use to our advantage and to our benefit. And I think it works really well because we know that the other person is going to stand her ground. There's no power imbalance between us. There's not one of us that's going to be like, oof, you know, I'm just going to accept what you said. No, if I disagree, I'm going to push back to what you said until we get to a point where we agree. And I think that's the difference with employees or people who aren't part of that dynamic, is there's a power imbalance. So they're of course not going to stand up to you the same way that a co-founder will stand up to you. So I think that needs to be, you know, acknowledged in a relationship as well.
But the business benefits the more your employees have the confidence to stand up to you.
Yes. Oh, absolutely.
So how can you force that more?
I think humility of also really clarifying to employees that, you know, you don't know what you're doing, and often I'm very transparent. It's like, this is the strategy that we're going to go for, but, you know, I might be wrong, and I want you to challenge me on that. owning up to mistakes and creating a culture of that being the norm. Really encouraging employees to do the same as well. Yeah, I think for me, there's nothing worse than someone making a mistake and then trying to hide and cover it up. I'd much rather just come to me and I'll never, you know, I'll try to see a way that it doesn't reproduce itself. I'll never personally, you know, attack you or, yeah, exactly. So creating an environment, I think, where they feel as much as possible on the same level as us in terms of expertise. And I think as first-time, you know, founders, we often hired people who were way more experienced than us. So it was literally like, actually, you know what you're doing. I don't know what I'm doing here. So, you know, I need you to challenge me because you've been in these situations before and I haven't. So I think that's important as well.
I'd love to touch on being a first-time founder in a second.
Yeah.
But going back to this dynamic with your sister,
Is
there a story of a time that you felt that your co-founder relationship was challenged the most? Where did you maybe disagree on something for a longer time, or does anything come to mind?
I don't think the relationship has ever been challenged to the point of thinking it wasn't going to work. I think we had to set up systems between us to actually set up also a working relationship beyond just a sister relationship. I think when we started the business, we both kind of have the similar backgrounds, both generalists. So we were kind of the same person. We were doing everything together, making every decision together. And then once we started hiring a team, we realized that doesn't work. We can't be, you know, seen as two people, but actually one person combined. And so we really had to get a coach and really help us set up a process of how we're going to split up our roles and responsibilities in a way where we also have a structure between us that isn't just this blind trust, but actually, you know, systematizes things so that employees can know, okay, if I have a question about this, then who do I go to speak about this topic? So I think this process of scaling a company is where we had to make some adjustments in the way we operate, because it moved from being just a, you know, a challenge that we were doing the two of us together to actually like, okay, there needs to be a business and a process around this. Otherwise, other people are just going to be confused and it's going to become a mess if we don't clean this up before they join.
At what point did you realize that you had to start systematizing and adding processes into this org chart?
Yeah, I think it was when we were like 5-6 employees and we weren't all in the same room anymore. That makes a big difference. So when we're all together, I feel like that just makes up for a lot. You can just have conversations with people if there's any doubts. The moment there's some people who are remote or hybrid, stuff gets lost in translation. And that's where, yeah, we had to build systems and processes. And, you know, I've always been someone who's a firm believer in just like human relationships. And I feel like I used to think, because I'm really, you know, I'm good with people, that would mean I was a good manager. And I had to realize that's not necessarily the case. It's very different to be, you know, a friendly person who can be sociable in a social context versus someone who can lead a team well, because it's not just about them liking you and you liking them. It's about, can you inspire them? Can you energize them? Can you set clear goals? How do you set constructive feedback? And learning for me that actually it's not a good idea to become friends with your employees. Because I think when I went into it, it was really this thing of like, we're all in this together, we're doing this. And actually, no, I am, and my sister and I are the co-founders, and there needs to be a level of distance there, because it's not supportive if, you know, you're my best mate at the same time as my employee, because then I'm going to also be scared to give you feedback, or there's just going to be a different dynamic in there. So accepting that employees aren't going to become my best friends, I think was a learning curve, especially once we had to fire people, and then you have to fire someone who's become your best friend, was just like, that was awful as well.
Can you tell me more about how you navigated this transition from feeling like you were good with people socially to being a manager? Like, what skills did you feel like you had to learn to develop to become a better manager, a better leader?
That's a good question. It's small things that I think have helped a lot. So something I do now with any new team member is I create a user manual. So I've got a user manual and everyone who joins the team writes their own user manual. I don't know if you've been through that process before, but it's things like, when I'm stressed, this is how I'll act. This is how I like to be communicated with, et cetera. And I think setting out clear expectations from day one, before anything has happened means that any sort of disagreement that will come later, you have something to refer back to. So a typical example is I expect people to be quite responsive on Slack during the day. And if they're not, I'll get frustrated if they haven't answered me in, you know, 7 hours or something like that. But for some people, that's not how they work. For them, it's like I might check Slack in the morning and I'll check Slack again when I'm logging off or something like that. And I feel like just it's such simple, that might sound obvious things, but just if you lay these things out initially, then it's like, okay, there's a disagreement here. How are we going to solve this? Okay, I need you to be more responsive on Slack as a simple example. So clarifying expectations was a big part of becoming a better leader.
Can you run through the different things that are on your scorecard?
I mean, it's a lot of stuff around like personality type. So this is the kind of stuff that I love doing the most. This is what I don't enjoy doing, how I am under pressure, any warning signs of like I'm getting into a space mentally that is not good, and how you can support me in those moments, things that I'd like you to remind me of, things that I'm not very good at, and that I'm trying to work on, those types of things, how I like feedback to be shared with me, whether it's, you know, directly or taking time apart or those kinds of things. Those are kind of the main buckets, yeah.
That's quite a advanced concept, which not tons of companies do. It feels very progressive. And I want to tie that into being a first-time founder. Did you learn this through, like, an investor, a mentor? Did you learn this from research? Or is this just a beginner's mind? This feels like it should be the right thing to do.
So it's interesting because I'm a first-time founder, but it's also my first job. Like, I've never been part of any other company. So I've never been managed before. And I think that was not something that worked to my advantage because, I don't know what good looks like. I don't know what bad looks like in terms of management. And I just don't know what a corporate culture feels like. That's just something I've never experienced before. And I think I quickly realized that was a shortcoming and I'd have to upskill as we were building out the team. So I have really invested heavily into coaching, and I think that's been a game changer for me, getting very experienced coaches who also understand, you know, the challenges of building a team early on and what that looks like. Yeah. Reading books, especially at the start, was really important for me. And then just speaking to other founders and asking, hey, how do you manage this? Like, just candidly admitting that you have no idea how you're going about this. And then people are willing to help and willing to support you. I think we got advisors on very early on as well into the business, and they've been game changers. It's much more senior people. They receive a little bit of equity, and we meet with them once a week. And often, you know, one of them was the CMO of Coinbase, for example, and he was helping us with our marketing strategy. But actually, very quickly, I realized he's just been such an experienced C-suite in a big business. He can help me on any topic. Like, he'll help me write emails that are very important, or he'll help me structure, you know, teams and stuff like that. So just finding people that have more experience than you and going to them openly and candidly and being like, hey, I actually really need your help. I've never had to do a performance review. How do you go about this? What have you learned and what works best? Because if you just go into it blindly, you might make a few mistakes.
I feel like that humility is actually such a superpower.
Yeah. Totally. And I think it's something that's lacking immensely in the startup world. I think we present this picture of a founder of like, yeah, this very masculine approach of just like fake it till you make it. You got to, you know, these like bros on Instagram and social media that are pretending to have everything figured out. And that paint that picture to investors as well. I think especially in the VC-backed ecosystem, there's a lot of that like founder ego almost that is like, I'm painting this very curated image of myself. And I think it works to our detriment because often, you know, as a founder, the humility of understanding where your weaknesses are and where your blind spots are, that becomes a strength if you can see that and if you can get support from people to show you those places. But you need to be willing to let them in and you need to be willing to be like, hey, actually, I don't know what I'm doing on this point and I need your help. And I'm overwhelmed right now because this is too stressful and I need your advice on this. And I think rarely founders, even though they experience overwhelm and stress and anxiety, are encouraged to go to that place of openness and vulnerability.
Asking for help is such a powerful but sort of deprioritized thing.
Totally, totally.
Amazing advisors, CMO of Coinbase, super experienced. Mm. How do you go about finding these people? Especially you said they brought them on super early days.
Yeah.
How early is it like?
Oh, nothing. Like the business doesn't even exist yet. And I think it's something, you know, people don't realize that with LinkedIn, you can just write to anyone. And most often they, you know, they might not reply, but sometimes they do reply. One of our first advisors was the founder of Nutmeg, the investment company, Nick Hungerford, who passed away a few months ago. And we had no common connections on LinkedIn whatsoever, but I really admired the way he'd built Nutmeg. I sent him, I mean, I read through it again the other day. It was just like chapter long LinkedIn message, which was just about all the, you know, very personal about all the ways I admired what he'd done, blah, blah, blah. And if he was willing to have a chat. And then for 4 months, he coached us. You know, he didn't even take equity. He just every week had a 1 hour call with us and shared advice on our strategy. And he was a game changer to the business. He introduced us to our lawyers. He introduced us to so many people in the ecosystem. And he just did it out of the goodness of his heart and because he believed in the mission and wanted to help founders. And I found that so often in the ecosystem, founders who are more experienced can so still remember and relate to how hard the early days were, that if you catch them at the right time, they're going to be willing to help. But so often people don't try and they don't write that message or something like that. So just message people, and you know, worst comes to worst, they never answer. I've written so many messages to Whitney Wolf, the founder of Bumble. She's never answered me. That's okay.
Can we see this message, or could you read us out the
message? For Nick Hungerford? Yeah, absolutely. I can find it again. Oh, here we go. It's called Your Advice on Financial Literacy for Women.
This is the title of your LinkedIn message?
Yeah.
Okay.
Random. I have since perfected my cold outreach message, but this was March 16, 2021. So Juno wasn't even incorporated yet as a company. Dear Nick, I know you're really busy and that you get a lot of messages, so this will only take 60 seconds to read. I'm the founder of a startup called Juno, a financial education platform for women. We have just raised investment at, so we had raised our pre-seed, with a mission to give every woman knowledge and confidence to start investing. I recently listened to a podcast that you were on. I know that financial literacy is a topic that you're really passionate about, and that you build Nutmeg with the same visions that we aspire to. Would you be open to sharing some advice with us? In particular, your experience making Nutmeg accessible and attractive for first-time investors. I totally understand if you're too busy to respond, but even a 10-minute call would be so valuable to us. All the best, Margot. Hi, Margot. Happy to meet you, and I'm very excited for your journey. No problem to have a chat. I'd love to learn more about Juno. Please can you email me, and we can fix a time. Please also send me a deck ahead of time so that I can get informed. Thanks, Nick. That was the start of the relationship with Nick.
And the impact of a relationship like that from the opening of a company is huge.
Momentous.
So how many other advisors did you have like that?
He wasn't even technically an advisor because he didn't even want equity. He was just, you know, doing it out of the goodness of his heart. And then we brought in a PR advisor who was also a game changer for Juno. She was our first official advisor, Harriet. And again, I contacted her on LinkedIn and she helped us get into the press very early on, which was, you know, we built our seed fundraise around a sifted article that came out a day before we opened the seed round. And then all the investors suddenly were aware of us and it was a total game changer for us. So as a general piece of advice, I think founders underestimate the impact of good PR in the early days in you know, getting that exposure and credibility. So she came on. And then the next one was we had John, the CMO of Coinbase, and then Elliot, head of content, and who's helped us a lot, kind of shape our content strategy, but also at any point, we have a WhatsApp group with him and we call him all the time and just are like, we need your advice on this. We don't know how to go about it. And he's been incredible as well.
He was head of content where, sorry?
Unmind.
Unmind.
Yeah.
Ah, cool.
Yeah. He's now their global director of marketing.
Very cool.
Such a sharp and switched on guy. And you need people like that, that you can just, for me, it's like intelligence and people who have the ability for like pattern recognition and who've just, you know, you can present them with any problem and you can tell their brain thinks so systematically throughout like the different options and outcomes. And even if they're not experiencing that specific problem, they're just such a helpful sounding board because they're going to reflect back to you like the different angles that they're seeing, or they're going to make a link with something that you'd never had, you know, made a link with. And I think especially as founders, that's so important to have people who can kind of take the bigger picture and zoom out. So he's been really great as well. And then investors have advised us as well.
And you were speaking earlier about your relationship with your investors.
I love my investors.
Which is a sort of position that every founder wants to be in, but not that many get to.
Yeah.
So tell us about how that has come about and what your relationship is like.
So we raised 2 rounds of investment. The first one was a pre-seed from angels and family and friends. There were 2 main angels who were, you know, they believed in us when we had nothing. Like, it was just Alexa and I, we had a PowerPoint presentation. I remember we had a call with them on the 23rd of December. And, you know, we presented the pitch to them and they were like, oh, so do you have an app prototype? And for some reason we said yes, and we did not have an app prototype. So like, okay, let's do a call after Christmas and you'll present to us the app prototype that you've got. Cool, great, we'll do that. And so
4 days.
They put the call on the 26th of December in the morning. So Alexa and I spent that Christmas just on YouTube tutorials and Figma trying to figure out how to build an app. I mean, I look back at this version of the app, which was, you know, utter disaster. But they just wanted to see that we, you know, we had the vision and had the willingness to do it. So we presented that app to them at 9 a.m. on the 26th, and then they invested. And one of them sits on our board, and we have the best relationship with him as well. And then we raised a seed round where we brought in 5 VCs and a whole bunch of other angels. And how do we have such a good relationship with our VCs? I think the humility piece is very important. We've never pretended that we've got all the answers, and actually we've been very open to their feedback and their expertise. And I think it's different to how other founders might relate to their investors. I think often we try to pretend like everything's going great. Founders are not stupid. Investors are not stupid. They know that, you know, building a company is a shit show. So if you're pretending like it's going super well every time you speak to them, they know that you're not telling them the truth, because, you know, that's not how a business is built. So we decided very early on that we'd just be fully transparent. And yeah, I mean, I've called them crying many, many times. Like, there's just so many moments where we've been at like total rock bottom and we feel like we can turn to them. And yeah, it feels like a very human relationship. I feel very supported. I don't feel like, you know, some founders share that they're almost feeling a bit exploited by the VCs, that the VCs are just trying to squeeze them to the maximum. I don't know. Our VCs encourage us to take holidays regularly, to take time off. They check in with us and they're like, how's your personal life? How are you doing on an individual level? And yeah, just at genuinely great people. And I think a lot of VCs are actually like that. Once you drop the label of, you know, I'm a VC, they're just a human like you, and you can connect on that level if you're willing to show them that side of you rather than the curated founder boss that you're trying to pretend to be on LinkedIn.
But it feels like one of those things you have to lead with.
Yeah.
As the founder. Well, I haven't heard of many VCs like saying, call me if you have like personal challenges. Which sounds like that's
totally
a reaction to how you've approached the relationship.
Yeah. And I think there's a selection bias as well, because initially we very quickly noticed when we were pitching Juno, and there were 2 reactions. Either the VCs saw our age, our like the freshness with which we approached the problem, and also our gender, as a superpower, meaning that we weren't the typical founder. And so then that built our credibility, and we kind of leveraged that and saying, you know, we're young, absolutely, but this is why we're going to be able to build a business that captures that exact target demographic. Or we had VCs that, you know, they'd take the first call and you could tell we weren't credible to them in the slightest. And then there was a selection process there where immediately they were out. And so they didn't become our investors. We were lucky that our round was totally oversubscribed, so we very quickly switched the question back to them on, like, not why should you invest in us, but why should we accept investment from you? And then you quickly see the ones that are actually believing in the fundamentals of what you're doing, or the ones who, you know, just see you as a cash cow. Yeah.
That's incredible. I think it's such a standard for so many founders to look for. And I love like what I took from what you're saying about how you lent into being young as a competitive advantage. I had a great guest on the show before, which is called Better Luca. She said your weakness can become an unfair advantage.
Totally.
Anything that differentiates that. You from another founder and potentially how that VC might relate to the founder, I think it's going to be really powerful. I have struggled with this as well, being the youngest, most inexperienced person running founders, community of 400 super experienced entrepreneurs. The imposter syndrome is very real. The feeling of being inexperienced and young is sometimes overbearing. How have you managed this identity piece?
That's a very good question. I think the first piece is not trying to pretend that it's not the case. So not trying to like present myself as the super experienced person who knows exactly what she's doing. But then the second one is, I think I made up for lack of experience in just very strong conviction in my intuition and common sense, I would say. So maybe I haven't been in this situation before, but I don't know, I really trust myself in making decisions. And of course I've made a lot of mistakes, but there's this fundamental sense that any sort of situation, even though I'm totally outside my comfort zone, I can manage and I can tackle. If I can ask the right people for advice and support, and then I can figure something out. So I think it's about building your own internal reference point. You might not be able to lean on examples in the past of, you know, the last time you experienced this specific situation, but actually you can find a way to just like fine tune your inner judgment when it comes to these situations and kind of go back to first principles and really methodically trust your like your first instinct. I think that's something I've worked a lot on.
I feel like there's a instinct and intuition which I share with you, which is around like whatever the problem is, I'll be able to find a way to solve it and I'll find the people who've solved it before and learn from them. But then that becomes potentially misleading when we create intuitive judgments about things we don't have as much experience
in.
And so then how do you balance when to lean on your intuition and when not to?
Yeah, absolutely. So bias and blind spots, I think, are a major, you know, if you need to be hyper aware of those. But it's back to the humility piece. It's back to actually, I operate 90% of the time in a place of, I actually don't know the answer to this question and I'm going to find it out. And I think that's a very strong position to be in, because then you don't come with preconceptions or with ideas of how it's been done in the past. You really come with it. It's just like, I'm going to figure it out. Yeah, humility of what you don't know and a willingness to learn and ask people for help to guide you.
And this leads in really nicely to what you were talking about earlier, which is how different people lead. And I feel like it's obviously a generalization, but a more masculine approach to say, I know the answer, I know what I'm doing, this is where we're going, follow me. And whether it's naive or not, having that like conviction, sort of faking it till you make it. So how do you balance or draw a distinction between leading in a masculine or feminine?
I think when I started being a founder, I immersed myself. I was listening to like, you know, Gary Vaynerchuk and all those podcasts, which were like the very American and very masculine hustle culture, go, go, go. You need to just like go fast and break things kind of approach, which gave me a lot of energy and inspiration. And I don't necessarily think there's something wrong in it per se, but it didn't work for me because I noticed that if I'm making decisions from that constant place of almost like fight or flight or this constant adrenaline, this isn't where I make my best decisions. I make my best decisions when I'm, you know, rested, when I can take a step back, when I can look at the full picture, when I've had time to think about a problem properly and realizing that, you know, you can lead from a very different place where you lead based on your values rather than kind of falling into the trap of constantly pushing for more. And I think that it's a difficult balance in the VC world, because obviously if you're raising VC money, there is this expectation that you're going to grow 10x every year and that it's, you know, this hyper growth focus, which often puts a lot of strain on resources and on founders. But proactively being like, I'm not going to engage with this sort of approach to running a business, and I'm going to set very clear boundaries around my work-life balance and making sure that I have enough time to resource myself and to come to a place of work where I feel excited and good about the work that I'm doing rather than being exhausted and completely depleted. Making sure that my employees have enough time to resource themselves, making sure that they also feel valued, that they're not kind of, you know, squeezed like a lemon, which I feel like a lot of startup employees also are. And then you create a sort of happy culture where people are genuinely willing to, you know, give their best. And if, then if there's a week of hyper stress and you need to do all-nighters, that's fine, but that's not the expectation on people. And I think from that place, you can create models of leadership that are just more sustainable and also create a more positive impact on the people that you're actually, you know, you're responsible for, because at the end of the day, you know, you're responsible for your employees and you want them to thrive as well in this adventure.
And those things don't feel like they feel like they're the end result of a more feminine approach to leadership. Obviously men can still achieve that outcome. There's obviously no, this is obviously generalizing.
Feminine and masculine for me is not so much about like the gender. It's more, I feel like we both, you know, every gender has feminine and masculine energies inside of us.
So what traits specifically feel more feminine leadership and what traits feel more masculine?
I mean, I would distinguish between like, we're going into like archetypes and stuff like that now, but like mature masculine and immature masculine, because I think immature masculine energy can be competitiveness to a point of like, just like, you know, fighting and coming from a place of lack, really this like forceful approach, anger. That for me is more like the immature masculine energy that I think a lot of people lead from. A mature masculine can be very present and can be very just like driven and determined, but less coming from this place of fear and lack. But I think feminine leadership for me is more cyclical. Like there's this thing of like accepting that, you know, it's not going to be a constant push in building a business. And actually it's this prospect of like working more in cycles. And maybe there's a period where you really, really have to grind hard and to push, but then there's also periods where you have to zoom out, when you have to look at the full picture, where you have to take a step back and maybe work less long hours to, you know, rejuvenate you and your team. It comes from a place of like compassion and really, yeah, pausing and taking time with the people that you work with to really understand of like who is the human behind this problem. Yeah.
Because
immature feminine for me is like the gossipy, bitchy energy. So there's a, it's not so much in leadership, I would say. I think the way we show up at work is mainly dictated by quite a masculine way of working in general, because I think the workplace has been quite masculine up until now. So we don't have that many role models of what like feminine leadership actually looks like, because most of the founders, most of the, you know, CEOs, they're all men, and a lot of the women who are in those positions actually need to take on the role of a man or need to present a lot of like assertive masculine traits to be taken seriously within that environment. So I still, it's something I, you know, I really felt like I lacked like examples of leadership, of feminine leadership that I really admired. Hence why I was like, I need to speak to Whitney Wolf or any very successful female founders that I feel are still embodying and staying true to their values as they've grown. And there's not that many of them actually, unfortunately. So I hope we can, you know, raise a new generation of just like feminine leaders who have more of those qualities.
I want to touch on as well what you said, where it's like everyone has a balance of masculinity and femininity, and they obviously bring that into their leadership style. Yeah. Like, I feel pretty in touch with my feminine side,
totally. Yeah.
Which as a bloke is like one of those things which make you feel a bit like, well, at least have made, I won't generalize, makes me feel a bit like tense, actually. It feels like another part of me, and like the authenticity and therefore leading from authenticity feels.
And you can feel it.
So what side of you is more masculine?
I think I have a strong masculine side as well. Work ethic is in, like the way I work, I think is quite masculine. It's something I've been trying to do, especially in my relationship actually. in the past is I get so into my masculine while I work that then often I struggle to switch it off. And I'm just like, I'm still in my like masculine decision maker when I'm home and when I'm in my relationship. And I think we're not together anymore, but that took a huge toll in our relationship because it was like, I couldn't drop back into a place of just like ease and softness. I was just like, go, 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 go all the fucking time. And I don't think that creates a very healthy dynamic at home. So mm-hmm. It's definitely still something that I know my sister does too, is we're both still working on like, how do we balance that? How do we get out of this like hyper masculine, which for me is also a lot to do with like being a lot in your head as an energy. Like, how do I drop back into my body after spending, you know, 10, 11 hours on the computer? What kind of practices can I do in my life that actually bring me back down and just find that, yeah, that softness, the spaciousness again. And I'm still totally learning how to do that.
Really powerful. Mm. My girlfriend and I did a sex workshop
not too long ago. Yeah.
And they had a definition of masculinity and femininity, interesting. Which I found really interesting. Yeah. Which was a lot about femininity is around surrender and masculinity is around control. And there's this push and pull between the two that each individual feels.
Mm.
And it's a dance, therefore, you have with your partner,
your
intimate. So I found that really interesting. And so I can imagine when you're at work, you're in control. It's in this definition of masculinity.
Yeah.
You go home and your partner's there being masculine as well.
Yeah.
And then another bro comes in the house.
Yeah, totally.
It's like he's expecting his girlfriend.
And often it's in my masculine relating to his masculine. We often joked about our relationship that there were four people in the relationship. And there's like my masculine, my feminine, his masculine, his feminine. And most of the time it was just, like you said, like bro to bro, which is fun. You know, it's great. We get on really well. But something that people speak a lot about is like the idea of polarity in a relationship, that you want sort of the balance between the masculine and the feminine. And I think it was one of the reasons why we broke up is we couldn't find that balance. I was in my masculine all the time.
And so what practices have you adopted more to try and get yourself in the feminine?
Dance, we spoke about. I think that's a really big part. So I noticed that the way I start my day is crucial in how things are going to develop for me. So I need to start my day with like at least 20 minutes of meditation, and then I put my headphones in and I dance. You know, no choreography, nothing special, but just literally actually feeling my body, waking up my body and just connecting to my aliveness and to just like all the different pieces of myself that want to come through. And I always end up with like some cheesy songs like Florence and the Machine or something like that, just in my room by myself, just singing and dancing. And then everything else becomes sort of playful and fun. And I think it's helped a lot in building the business because we can get so stuck in taking everything so seriously as a founder and making such a big deal out of it all. Because it does feel like a big deal. Of course, it's like you're building your baby. But being able to reconnect, like, this is all just a game. I'm giving it a crack. And, you know, the worst that can happen is we need to close shop and that'll be okay. I'll survive that. And I want to enjoy the process. And so if I can connect back to that playfulness, then even if it's super fucking stressful, I'm like, I've chosen this. How can I enjoy it? How can I make it fun? And how can I laugh about the fact that this problem came on the worst possible day that it could arise, rather than it being this like, oh, what am I going to do about this? So that's helped a lot.
I love that framing of how you can make this more fun. And also that's a key to productivity as well. So Ali totally. Abdel, who we spoke about earlier, that's one of his things.
Yeah.
It's like, how can I make this more fun? Yeah. And it's a lot easier to manage that part pre the work day. Say in the morning, you can dance and you can be very playful and silly.
Yeah.
And then usually when we go into the office, it sort of
dissolves.
Dissipates.
Yeah. Yeah.
How do you cultivate playfulness and fun in the office?
I'm still learning to do that for sure. I think my sister and I kind of try to bring that energy both within ourselves. We try to make things funny. We try to just like find the lightness in the day. I struggle to do it during the day often. I try to be very good at switching off at the end of the day. I think when I was starting building Juno, you know, I was working 24/7. We were speaking about this, like the beginning enthusiasm. It was like pre-dinner, post-dinner, every like waking hour. Now I try to be much more boundaried around my working days. And I need at least, you know, at least 2-3 hours between the time I switch off work and when I go to bed. Because otherwise, something for me is I dream about work all the fucking time. And it doesn't leave my brain. It feels like I haven't rested because I'm just dreaming about work. Especially if I work and then go straight to bed afterwards, it'll be just like my workday continues in my head. So taking that time, moving my body again, like trying to exercise every single day, not for any sort of fitness goal or anything like that, but just actually, like, I need to feel like I'm more than just like my thoughts in my brain. And then having a good routine, trying to find time for social life really helps as well. Having friends that don't care about your business because they're doing something totally different, and just getting that sense of perspective of like, you're an artist, you don't care about a Series A, you realize that like the world continues to move on and, you know, nothing matters in the big scheme of things.
Capitalism is the worst.
Exactly.
I can't believe you're doing this to the world. Yeah.
Exactly. And they just can't relate with your problems. And yeah.
I know you're helping 100,000 women, but do it exactly. with less money.
Do more beauty in the world. What have you done today that's beautiful? Like, yeah, what am I doing? It's back to the thing of playfulness, of like taking a step back out.
But most of those things do feel outside of the work.
Yeah.
The sort of book.
Yeah.
A book ends. Yeah. If you were to...
Dance in the middle of the day.
If you were to play a game now,
yeah.
Which part of your workday feels the most serious?
I try to do like at least 2 or 3 hours of deep work every day where I just don't take meetings and I'm hyper-focused on whichever task I'm doing. That feels the most serious because I'm timing myself. I'm doing these like Pomodoros and then I take a 5-minute break and I come back exactly at the right time. I need that structure.
Within that structure, how could you incorporate more play and fun?
Maybe if I start dancing every 5 minutes or like doing the 5-minute Pomodoro breaks, I think that should be something we do at WeWork. It's just have like a little dancing corner or like a little then yeah, finding ways of like infusing that more into music, playful music. I used to listen to like techno as I work, and actually it doesn't help me either because it's just again this like whereas if I'm more like melodical and piano, then I can feel like, ah, you know, it's all good.
I find that my mind is going so fast that actually I probably don't need the music to go at the same space,
totally.
The same pace as my mind.
Yeah.
With classical, actually, it's like cool,
grounded. Yeah. And I think that's back to the point of how do we show up at work? I feel like we're in such an like adrenaline-infused workplace where it's like, have the coffee, have the loud music, have the go, 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 like constantly pushing. And that doesn't work for me. Like I've stopped drinking coffee because, again, like I'm nervous and anxious as it is. Like I don't need the extra stimulation to feel on edge even more.
I am conscious of time, so I'd love to... transition.
We've covered a lot of ground. We've covered your sex workshop. We've covered.
Yeah, exactly. To finish this part around work and relationships at work, what's a human-centered moment that you've had in the process of building Juno that sticks in your mind or your heart?
Well, I can share the one that I just shared with you before we came on, which is we're going through a big process with a company, which hopefully...
Let's talk about that.
Yes, should drive some pretty cool results. And our CTO, who's been with us...
Oh, God, tell us exactly what it is.
We're trying to get acquired. So we're going for an acquisition, which hopefully should happen soon. You're here on the crucial day where I'll find out in 2 hours if it goes through. So
I was really hoping that you were going to get the text during
through the podcast.
And I'd be like, tell us what it says.
Yeah, but except if it was a heartbreaking text on
on camera. I'm
just like, okay, Margot's crying. We're going to cut the podcast.
It's very real.
Exactly, very real. And he shared a message with us. He's by far the most experienced person we've ever hired. He's worked in a lot of companies. His previous company got acquired by Snapchat. Like,
who is this, sorry?
CTO. And he sent us a really touching message a few weeks ago as this process was happening. And he said, when I started working with you, I was so shocked by the way you do business and the place you come with and the fact that you show up in such a different way to all the macho environments I've been in the past. But I've always had this voice in my head that, you know, this can't work. They're not going to succeed like this. You need to do business in this macho way to succeed. And he said, I'm very happy to be proven wrong and to see that, you know, you can have success without being this sort of macho leader. And I think that was really heartwarming because it's true. Like, as you're going through it, you're making it up as you go and you have no idea if you're doing the right thing or not. And, I mean, luck has been a huge part of this as well. But actually realizing that you can build a successful business, sticking to your values and not being a shark, not being this competitive, ruthless person that takes advantage of others. And Yeah, that for me is really... I'm glad that that's the outcome that I got to, because if the outcome was you can't do business like that, I think I would have retired in a little countryside home and called it a day.
Become a hermit.
Exactly.
I feel this notion of founders getting positive feedback is so underrated.
Yeah.
And undervalued.
And we don't often get positive feedback. That's the problem. And I think that the noise in the industry is totally flawed as well, because when do founders get celebrated is when they've raised a round of investment. That's what the press, that's what people announce on LinkedIn, and is like this big milestone moment. And of course that should be celebrated because it is an achievement. But actually, that's not building a sustainable business. That's just having convinced investors to give you more money. And we're not celebrating enough the sort of, you know, you've got a happy team, you're a profitable business. Like, who cares if you're raising money? You're making money. That's even better. So again, I feel like the things that are celebrated within the founder world are also often sometimes the wrong things.
If you were able to rewrite what was celebrated in the founder world, what would be the new LinkedIn posts?
I mean, profitability would be a massive one. I think, you know, like, we're all building businesses and so few people are actually making money. I think if you've bootstrapped your business and you're making sustainable money, that is much bigger of an achievement in my eyes than having raised a Series A, because I think that's much harder to do. And then being healthy and being happy. There was a Sifted survey done recently in terms of the percentage of founders that felt anxious. And I think it was something like 79% of founders feel anxious to a point that it's detrimental to their work. That's fucked up. Like, that's a lot of people. And I mean, I've been in that boat as well. But actually, we should celebrate, you know, people who've been able to run a business and build a system around them that they don't have to feel anxious building a business, because I don't think that's how we do our best work, by feeling anxious. It's, yeah.
Perfect segue into how do you stay on top of your mental health?
It's been a journey. I never used to feel anxious before Juno, and it definitely came where, for me, it's again that thing in the morning. Like, I'll wake up and have just like anxiety in my chest and it's like bold in my stomach. And that was totally new to me. I had never experienced that before. I think a few things have helped, like coaching and therapy, number one, like getting like professional support from people. I think the combination of the two is actually really important, because, you know, therapy is more the emotional side of things, and maybe looking back at like past traumas that you've had that make you feel like that, or kind of unpicking your beliefs. And coaching is more the forward-looking approach. So how are we going to change this? What systems are we going to set in place? So doing both of that has been a game changer. Then just like what we were sharing earlier, practices around meditating, exercising, eating well, seeing friends, just like those kinds of things. But then again, also being open with my co-founder, my sister, but also other team members on days when it's not going well. And actually, like, yeah, I need support right now. I think after my breakup, I really went through a phase where I was struggling, you know, a lot. The combination of high stress of the acquisition, but then also feeling just like emotionally totally raw, grieving the end of the relationship, and being willing to show up in that, you know, and ask for support in those moments. And I was telling you this anecdote of a call I had with one of our biggest clients that is a big bank. And on the call, it was just fresh after the breakup. And I tried to like put myself together in the call and was like, it's going to be fine. And then I start crying in the middle of the call. And we start speaking about the breakup and how I'm just not coping well. And this director of strategy at this big bank then sends me a bouquet of flowers to my home and just send like a really heartfelt message, just like, you know, life is tough, take care of yourself. And since then, our relationship has been totally different because we've built that like human connection. So I think, again, like being willing to bring that in as well and not pretend that you're superhuman and that as the founder, you know, nothing ever affects you, but actually, you know, like I'm having a tough time right now. I need your help. And being willing to say that. Yeah.
This thread that runs through, I think, is like the humility and courage to be vulnerable and ask for help. Which does take a lot of courage, difficult. And however, I think it's easier for earlier stage founders. There is that natural humility.
Totally.
As people look, I think, to later stage founder for the answers.
Yeah, and they need to have figured it out by that point. Yeah, totally. Yeah, because late stage founders, I mean, in business in general, we have so little humility. We often, you know, people... there is still this very much this thing of like separate selves at work and at home. And you don't see a lot of senior leadership people, you know, voicing their mental health. Although it's changed a little bit recently, but I still think we're not doing it enough.
Blending into the more personal side, about you as an individual, what's been some of the biggest lessons you've taken from coaching and therapy?
That's a tough question. I think for me was the acceptance that I can't do everything at once. I think when I started Juno, I was, 22, 23, and all my friends were, having a very active social life. They were going out a lot. They were traveling. They were doing all these things that I was missing out on. And there was a voice inside of me that was like, what are you doing? You're wasting your 20s. You're working insane hours. You should be doing the same. And I had this idea that like I should be able to manage it all at once. I should be able to both be hypersocial, be super fit, and take super good care of my health, and be able to be a founder at the same time and do all the things at once. And then I realized actually no, that's not how it's going to work. And I see my life less in like trying to be all the things at the same time and at once, but more almost like work-life balance over a lifetime. So now are the years where I'm going to work a lot, and that's going to sacrifice, my relationships are going to take a toll. My partnership was made really difficult because of the amount I was working. But actually, I understand that this is what I'm devoting my life to right now, but I know that it's not going to be like that forever. And I know I'm going to have a phase in a few years where, I'm working minimal hours, I'll have many lovers, I'll be traveling the world, I have many friends, like that phase will come. But it's if I can speak to that part of myself that is like, but I want that right now, to be like, I hear you and it's going to happen, but it's not going to happen right now. We can't do it all at once. And once I've let go of that expectation, it's been such a relief, because it's like, okay, actually it's less pressure to also, go out all the time and have a super active social life. No, I'm not going to do that right now. And then surrounding myself with people who had the same priorities as me at this time. Like, you're also working insane hours and you're also struggling in your relationship. Great, we're in this together. And yeah, that's helped a lot.
Could we talk about your relationship?
Yeah, of course.
Because this is something that I found so interesting when we met properly a couple of years ago. You were in an open relationship.
Yeah.
And you had a structure with your partner where you quite happily go on dates and with other people. But there was obviously, well, maybe not obviously, there was a lot of transparency and there's a lot of making the other person feel included and involved and respected and cared for in this whole process, which is crazy. So, and well, it's crazy to many people, I think. I don't want to add labels to it, because I think it's incredible in so many other in so many ways. And you would have sort of calls with people that your partner was going on dates with, and he would have calls with people that you're going on dates with. Like very, very open. Such a standard for communication. What helped you communicate things that felt vulnerable or you felt a constriction naturally as the first instinct when thinking about communicating?
It's funny, I was reading an article about that was exploring like polygamy and polyamory, and actually they found that like the hotspots of that is often like San Francisco, London, the city where there's a lot of entrepreneurs, because they found a strong correlation between people who try to question the way business is done with the way relationships are done. And often entrepreneurs are the ones who'll be like, fuck monogamy, let's explore something else.
Yeah.
So I definitely relate with that as just a wanting to, can we do things differently? How can we challenge the way things has been done? But yeah, back to your point about communication and vulnerability, I think, self-awareness is kind of the cliche word, but really understanding and taking responsibility for your own emotions is key. And I think so often, we feel angry, we feel upset, but actually what's underneath that is we're hurt and we're scared, and actually tuning into that and feeling that part of ourselves that's like, I feel jealous, but really what I need right now is you to reassure me, and I need to take ownership of that, and rather than projecting onto you like, how the fuck could you do this to me, I can be like, hey, actually I'm really scared and hurt right now, I feel like the girl you're dating is 10 times more beautiful than I am. She's skinnier than I am. I feel like she's a better match than you. This little voice in my head feels super insecure right now. I need you to reassure me, and I need you to tell me, you know, what you love about me. And being willing to ask for that is similar to what we said about, you know, asking for support and then receiving it and really trusting the other person to also, you know, be truthful. And then, yeah, it's such a new and beautiful level of communication where you can care for your hurt, but you don't have to act from it. So it's you feel the strong emotions and you can support it, but you don't kind of become reactive and defensive or aggressive or anything like that.
More curious.
Yeah,
about
exactly.
Where it's come from, yeah. And why it's there.
Yeah, and the foundation of that, I think, is a feeling of just a deep conviction that you'll be okay no matter what and that you've got yourself. So even if my partner leaves me or even if this business breaks down or even whatever happens, I know that I'll be okay and I know that the worst case scenario is fine. It'll be manageable. It'll be super fucking tough, but I can handle it. And I think, you know, mentally also exploring the worst case scenario in your head and realizing that no matter what happens, it'll be okay also takes the pressure away a little bit, because whether it's business or relationship, like you realize, actually, I've been single in the past and yeah, it's going to hurt to not be, you know, a breakup, but I'll be okay. And I'll find my feet again. So yeah, I think that's a big thing of open relationships as well. Trusting that you'll be okay on your own. It's what we were saying earlier, like the existential loneliness of being okay with just being on your own.
What other existential threats do you battle with?
I mean, something I've been thinking a lot about is mortality and just the fact that we're all going to die and everything we create is going to die. And I think it's something, again, that we don't live closely, like we don't think about enough as a society. We've really just like made death this massive taboo, even though it's the one thing that we know for sure it's going to happen to all of us, every single one of us. And yet when it happens to someone, it's like, oh, it's such a shame. I can't believe, you know, so unexpected that this person died. It's like, well, no, this is the only thing that we know for sure is that every single person is going to die. And so we have just a short time on this life, and I want to live it fully and I want to experience it fully and just say yes to the full spectrum of what it wants to present to me, be it positive emotions or negative emotions, you know, not labeling them and being like, I'm super sad right now. Like, what does sadness feel like in my body? Can I really just drop into the sadness that I'm experiencing right now? Can I feel into just like the extents and the intensity of the emotion that wants to come through me in this sadness, rather than trying to bucket it away as a sort of negative emotion that I'm trying not to feel? Because ultimately, like, at the bottom of sadness is just also just like feeling alive. I don't know if you've ever had that feeling of just like you're crying and crying and crying in a way, like then it transforms into laughter, because it's just like it's so cathartic in a way when you really let yourself feel what you deeply want to feel. Yeah, so coming to terms with our own mortality, I would say. That's my advice for founders out there.
My girlfriend's would resonate so with what you just said. And she is amazing at feeling her feelings.
Yeah, yeah.
And I really struggle with it. I often think this emotion doesn't serve me. I'm going to refocus my energy to a different emotion. I view emotions as like the reaction, the sort of subconscious reaction, which I know is powerful and important, but not urgent. It's usually this, what do I need now? Not this emotion.
Yeah.
Therefore, put it in a box, push it aside, and I'm going to reframe this.
Does that work though? Putting emotions in a box and then...
I don't know. I can't speak with confidence. And I haven't spent enough time reflecting on it, But I mean, like, I feel like I also do therapy and coaching. Mm-hmm. And so these things get looked at and analysed. But I suppose I've noticed that I'm quite an impulsive person, quite reactive. And so a lot of my wisdom comes from slowing down and parking something to then go over it a couple of times. Like, for example, my girlfriend and I, we've recently started doing relationship check-ins.
Okay.
And a dedicated hour or 2 hours or whatever it is. Yeah. Answer 14 questions.
Yeah.
They're all framed in a very positive way.
Do you have a Notion board for your...
Of course. So it's your question, is that? I've got her onto Notion as well, obviously.
Obviously.
And so now we have a shared Notion page and it's all on Notion. And that was really helpful for me because it was this dedicated time talk about maybe challenging things, or things that I didn't align with, or things that annoyed me in our relationship, or whatever. Mm-hmm. Whereas normally in the moment I'd be like, oh, like, do you have to leave my, or do you have to like walk outside with my slippers? Yeah. That was one of the small things that I was like, oh, they're my indoor shoes. Like, for fuck's sake. It was such a tiny thing, right? From not trying, well, I did react in the moment with those. There were other things that were similar. And from not reacting with those other things, I looked at all of the different very small circumstances and could zoom out and be like, oh, okay, the high level thing here is like, it doesn't feel like she respects my things as much as her things. Now, that's not how, obviously, she views it. Of course.
Yeah.
That's how the story I was telling myself. And so that then gave me the patience to zoom out and be like, when you do this, these things, example one and two, this is what how it makes me feel. And that was really helpful just for me with being like, okay, their emotions are there, interesting. I don't need to react in the moment, but actually this is helpful to direct or help me synthesize my thoughts.
Yeah, but I think there's a nuance in what you're describing there, because you're giving yourself space to feel the things that you need to feel, but you're just allocating a sort of dedicated time to it. So you're not kind of acting out of the freshness of the emotion, and maybe, you know, the moment she walks outside with your slippers or something like that, like you're taking that emotion.
Problem. I love it. She says to me all the time, she's like, if you think this is a problem, then
this is as bad as it gets. Yeah. But you're still letting yourself process those emotions and understand what's at the root of them. So this thing of lack of respect, for example, that, you know, magnifies itself through these different situations. I think the trap that a lot of people fall into is they think they can just kind of like think themselves out of sadness and negative emotions as a whole. I think as a society, especially the American culture, we've become so obsessed with this sort of like optimistic thinking, manifesting, everything needs to be exactly like everything needs to be happy and good all the time, because if you think a negative thought, then you're going to create it in your life or something like that. And I think that's a trap, because if you don't give yourself space to actually, you know, understand what those negative emotions are trying to tell you, then they're going to come up in a different way. They're going to come up through anxiety or things in your body not feeling right anymore. So I think there's a nuance between, you know, timing things and processing them on a different timeline versus trying to just like, I'm just a happy person, I'm not going to process sadness and stuff like that.
This feels also like letting things naturally flow, which also feels more feminine in nature. Which actually is interesting, because I leant into that more so when my girlfriend and I had a small break of like a few months, and when I was in Lisbon, when we hung out.
Yeah.
And one of the things I remember doing is whenever I felt sad, I was living by myself, and so like I was there to feel the emotions, feel the feelings. And when I was feeling sad, I had this playlist, which I called I'm Sad and That's Okay.
Yes.
A hot. And
I love that.
I'd play it and I'd just like sing like to Rihanna or whoever the fuck it was.
Totally.
And it would be so helpful.
Yeah.
It didn't feel like I was actually doing anything like proactive with like, I was journaling as well. I'm like, I'm journaling, or I'm like talking through my emotions with someone. It was just like I'm going to like sink into these minor chords and just like embody that pain that this artist is going through as well.
Yeah,
and that was really powerful. And I actually only recently renamed the album I'm Slow and That's Okay, because that's kind of how I related to it when now being back. I'm like, I'm not so sad, but actually like I need time to slow down. And so that was really powerful for me.
But I think we're it's almost I like that you brought it back to the feminine and the masculine energy, because I think what we've been speaking about in this is almost like stepping away from this idea that the human can just be a machine. And I think as founders, that's often what we try to pretend is happening, is like, I'm just this execution, go, go, go machine. And I think that's a trap that no one benefits from. And often that's the sort of like more masculine approach to work. So reinventing what it looks like to show up for work, acknowledging that we're not machines, we're human emotional beings who go through breakups, who go through sad moments. And actually, as you said, like, can we come from that place and then turning those weaknesses, so-called, into superpowers, closer to our intuition, closer to our compassion, our caringness, our desire to make a change in the world, connecting to like that impact and desire that we have from a place of tenderness and softness and slowness rather than this robotic, just like, I'm going to finish this and I'm going to execute.
And that's actually like the pillar to this journey that I'm on with this content. It's all about the people side of work,
completely.
The human element. It's about incorporating these different parts to ourselves which haven't been commonplace in work or in startups, trying to shed light on that and how it can be our superpower if you incorporate all these different parts to ourselves and understand them in other people and build that into the culture, build that into the way of working. Lastly, what part of you do you embody more so outside of work? You have this sort of silly, playful nature that you have at the start of your work day and maybe the end as well. Is there other sides of you that express more freely
outside of work? Definitely. I mean, like, my more spiritual side comes through more outside of work. My sexual side definitely doesn't come through. My more autistic side as well.
More artistic.
Just like being a friend. Being a really committed friend. Those are maybe aspects of myself that I like to work on.
And on that note, being a committed friend.
Oh God, what is coming now?
Having spoken to one of your best friends.
What are you gonna have? Ah, you recorded it. Should I click play?
You'd turn up. How would you describe Margot?
Okay. She's incredibly attentive. She can be a huge shapeshifter when the circumstance requires it. She's wild at heart, but so soft. And gentle in relationships and communication. She really knows how to balance well, like, problems in life, but not even problems, just any sort of situations. She tends to find her balance quickly, which is very rewarding and also makes all of us so jealous because we're all over the shop. Very curious. And I think that's what gets her far in life. Very intelligent, but also emotionally intelligent, that she's worked on. And it doesn't always come, you know, easy. But with work, it came sort of alongside her professional work. Her also emotional intelligence rose. But I find her very strong. She's like a very strong woman. She's incredibly caring, inventive, intuitive, inspirational. Obviously, coming from a friend, she's like absolutely the best friend I could have asked for.
That is so sweet. We're speaking about positive words of affirmation, and it's wonderful that you recorded that and that you're sharing it.
You're very welcome. One of the things I also want to touch on was Dunya, your best friend, said that you're a very strong woman, and in my research, I learned that you were raised by a single mum, very like strong single mum. Can you talk about what you took from growing up in a single sort of parent mother household, which is also the same as me?
Independence, I think, sometimes to my detriment. This belief that like I really need to figure stuff out by myself is. You know, we spoke a lot about asking for help, but actually at the core instinctively I'd much rather just like not lean on anybody else. And yeah, this belief, whether it's true or not, that at the end of the day we're always going to be alone, and that I have only got myself. So that I think was a very strong imprint.
From your mom.
Yeah, from my mom as well. That you can't rely on like a man or any other situation to sort you out, basically.
Do you mind me asking what happened with your dad?
Yeah, they divorced early on. He's still in the picture, and you know he's great and loving as well. But I think for her, it was a really clear sense of just like either I'm going to stand on my own 2 feet, or I'm not independent, or I'm, you know, I need to be in situations that I don't want to be in. Financially, that's been a huge factor as well for us. Like Juno is a financial education app, and for women, because we see so many women who are in situations where they leave money management to their male partners, and then they find themselves in situations where they can't leave because they don't have money for themselves, or they don't know what's happening with the household money, that, you know, the partner manages the investments, the mortgage, etc. So I'm such a firm believer in keeping your options and your choices open so that no matter what, you can get out of a situation. Something we speak a lot about in Juno is like a fuck-off fund. Having an amount of money that is yours only so that you can get yourself out of any situation that doesn't support you, whether it's a partner, whether it's a job that's, you know, turning out not good for your mental health, an apartment, whatever, but just having that fuck-off fund to just be like, fuck off to any situation that doesn't help you. And the freedom that comes from that is a game changer. So yeah, having you know, trusting people, but keeping your options clear, that you don't need to become codependent or too reliable on other people to the detriment of your own freedom.
Wow. I've loved this conversation so much.
Me too.
Thank you so much for coming and sharing your wisdom. You have buckets of wisdom. So it's been an absolute pleasure.
Likewise. You're such a good interviewer. And I loved your thing of making this the best interview of my life. And I think you managed. I think it's been the best interview of my life.
That's
my testimonial right there.